hear their footsteps anymore, then pulled on my dress and raced down the hall to Bliss's room. She sat on her floor with a stack of clay beside her and what looked like a teddy bear massacre on cookie sheets in front of her. "What was the fuss?" I sprawled on her bed as I told her, and she giggled herself into near hysterics. "How long do you think until he bans Avery completely?" "I don't know if he would ever do that," I said regretfully. "Avery is hard enough to control when he's here. How much harder must it be out there?"
"We'll never find out."
"That's true." She handed me a ball of clay to knead. "Can I ask you something personal?" "Personal like how?"
"Do you love him?"
I almost asked which him, especially since we'd just been talking about Avery.
But I realized what she meant half a second before I could make myself look like an idiot.
I glanced up at the winking red light of the camera and slid off the bed so we were huddled together.
"No."
"Then why are you doing all this?"
"Do you believe a butterfly escaped?"
"No." "Maybe, sort of."
"Wait."
"Well, fuck. Suddenly the world makes sense again. Think it'll work?"
"I don't know," I sighed, kneading the ball of clay. "He's horrified of being his father's son, but he's also... proud? For the first time in his life, it's easy for him to see that his father is proud of him. That still means more to him than I do, and he's too scared to think of right and wrong."
"If there had never been a garden, if you'd met him at the library or something, do you think you'd love him?"
"Honestly? I don't think I know what that kind of love is. I've seen it in a few others, but for myself,
maybe I'm just not capable of it. I can't decide if that's sad or safe."
"I can't think of any reason it can't be both." The couple across the street loved each other almost to distraction, and the arrival of their baby somehow made them more complete, rather than detracting from what they had between them. Rebecca, the lead hostess at the Evening Star, deeply loved her husband, who happened to be Julian's nephew, and sometimes seeing them together was so sweet we all melted a little.
Even as we teased them, of course.
Taki and Karen had it, their daughter and her wife had it. But each time I saw it, I knew I was in the presence of something extraordinary. Something that not everyone found, or was capable of recognizing and sustaining.
And I'm the first person to admit that I am one fucked up individual.
"That's fair. And honest." She took the clay from me and handed me another. This one a bright fuchsia that left colored streaks all over my skin.
"We never really thank you."
"What?" "You take care of us," she said quietly, her brilliant blue eyes locked on the teddy bear forming in her hands.
"It's not like you're maternal or anything, because really, fuck that. But you give the tough love and you listen, and there's that interference you run with the gardener in that private room of his."
"That's not something we need to talk about."
"All right. Give me the clay and go wash your hands."
Bemusedly, I did as she said, scrubbing the fuchsia streaks from my skin. She handed me a turquoise ball of clay. This time when I sat down beside her, I actually looked at all the pieces. Half the scattered teddy bear parts, heads, paws, and tails, were black, the other half white. Some of them had actually been assembled with uniforms, the black in shades of red and the white in shades of blue. Half of each color were slightly larger and their uniforms more ornate, and several of them seemed to be paired.
"Are you making a chess set?"
"Nazira's 20th birthday is in a couple of weeks." And my 18th birthday was a few weeks after that, but birthdays weren't generally celebrated in the garden. It felt a little too much like mockery, like we were celebrating how much closer we were to death. Other people got to look at a birthday and say, "Yay, 1 year older!" We met our birthdays with, "Fuck, 1 year less."
"It's not a birthday gift," she continued sourly. "It's an I'm sorry your life sucks so fucking much gift."
"Good gift."
"And shitty timing," she agreed.
She rolled a tiny ball of gold clay into a rope, pinched it in half, twirled it together, and the Red King got a shoulder braid for his uniform.
"Do you hate him just a little, too?"
"More than a little."
"He would be going against his family."
"Whereas now he's just going against common decency and the law," I sighed. I held out the softened clay, and she handed me a ball of royal blue.
I knew better than to ask to make one of the bears. My clay creations sucked.
Bliss, I guarantee you there isn't a side of this I haven't turned over in my head. It stopped making sense a long time ago, if it ever did.
So, just go with it and see what happens.
Pretty much.
He's coming.
Footsteps sounded down the hall, growing louder. And a moment later, Desmond walked in and dropped to the floor beside me, handing each of us an orange.
Is that a chess set?
Bliss rolled her eyes and didn't answer, so while she made teddy bear soldiers, I kneaded the clay, and Desmond played with his iPod and travel speaker to continue the concert.
And that orange? First and only time I ever got the peel off in a perfect spiral.
Edison finally returns holding two bags, one containing bottles of soda and water, the other with what proves to be meatball subs. When he gives one to the girl, he also pulls a small plastic bag from his pocket and sets it on the table before her. She picks up the bag, then stares at the contents.
My little blue dragon!
I talked to the scene techs. They said your room was protected by the cliff.
He sits down across from her, busying himself with unwrapping his sub. Out of courtesy, Victor pretends not to see his blush.
They'll box everything up for you once it's released, but they went ahead and gave me that one to pass on.
She opens the bag and cradles the small clay creature in her hands, one thumb rubbing over the tiny pajama-clad teddy bear tucked into the crook of its arm.
Thank you,
she whispers.
You've been more forthcoming. Somewhat.
She smiles.
Vic, the scene techs are looking through the house. They'll let us know if they find the pictures.
For a time, conversation stops as they eat, though the girl has to wrap her tender hands in napkins to hold the hot sandwich. When the meal is done and the debris thrown away, she picks up the sad little dragon and curls her hands around it. Victor decides it's his turn to be brave.
What happened to Avery?
What do you mean?
Did his father punish him?
No, they just had a long talk about respecting each other's privacy, and that the butterflies were not possessions to be passed around, but individuals to be cherished. To hear Des tell it, there was also a pretty sharp reminder that Avery wasn't allowed to touch me anyway, given the whole branding thing. Well, given the prior incident. And Des had never asked about the scar on my hip. If you don't ask, you can keep your head buried in the sand.
So things went back to normal.
Such as it was.
But something had to change.
Something did. Its name was Keeley.
Or, more properly, its name was Avery, and its victim was Keeley. I saw a lot less of Desmond once the semester started. It was his senior year, and he was carrying a full course load. But he came in the evenings and brought his textbooks so he could study, and just like I'd helped Whitney, Amber, and Noemi study once upon a time in the apartment, I helped him. Without booze. Bliss helped, too, by making fun of him whenever he got something wrong. Or even just not completely right. Bliss seized on any opportunity to make fun of him, really. Avery's mood went from foul to worse as he watched his brother be such a part of the garden. Like I said, most of the butterflies liked Desmond. He didn't ask anything of them. Well, he asked them questions and left it to them whether or not to answer. He asked their names sometimes, but it had somehow become a tradition in the garden that you only gave your name as your goodbye. But we told him that Simone had once been Rachel Young, that Lionette had been Cassidy Lawrence. Any of the ones we knew who couldn't be hurt by the reminder. Desmond wasn't a threat to them. Avery, on the other hand, savaged Zara so badly during sex that his father banned him for a full month, then had to drug him to avoid the hissy fit that tried to follow. Zara could barely walk after that, and every part of her was bruised. Someone stayed with her at all times just to help her with basic functions like showering, getting to the toilet, and eating. Lorraine was a competent enough nurse, if hardly a compassionate one. But she wasn't a miracle worker. Infection set into Zara's hip, and it was either take her to a hospital or put her in glass. I think you can safely guess which one the gardener chose. For the first time, he told us that morning, so we could have a full day with her to make our goodbyes. I gave him a sideways look when he told me that, which was meant with a lopsided smile and a kiss to the temple.
Even when it's just a swift embrace and a stolen whisper, you share things with each other in those moments. If it can provide Zara and the rest of you any comfort, I'd like to see that you get it.
I said thank you because he seemed to expect it, but part of me wondered if it was better to just have it happen all at once, rather than dragging it out over the day. Before he left for class, Desmond brought us a wheelbarrow so we could maneuver Zara through the garden. He smiled when he brought it, smiled as he kissed my cheek and left for school, and Bliss swore so fluently that Teresa blushed.
"He doesn't know, does he?"
she panted, when she could speak a language other than obscenity.
"He really has no clue."
"He knows Zara is ill. He thinks he's doing something nice."
That...
Some things don't need a translator. That afternoon, while the gardener walked with his wife in that other greenhouse that was so much closer than it seemed, Zara pushed herself up to sitting on her bed, sweat matting her fiery orange hair.
"Maya? Bliss? Can you wheel me around for a bit?"
We folded a blanket into the wheelbarrow and arranged a few pillows under and around her, stabilizing her hip as much as possible. It wasn't her only broken bone, but it was decidedly the most painful.
"Just in a lap through the hallway," she instructed.
"Looking for real estate?" Bliss asked, and Zara nodded. It was something you couldn't help but wonder about. When you died, which case would you be in? I was pretty sure I knew which one the gardener had picked out for me. It was right beside Lionette, and positioned in such a way that you could see it from the cave. Bliss thought she'd be on my other side, just the three of us, hanging out forever in the fucking wall for future generations of butterflies to wonder about and fear. We walked slowly through the hall, me pushing the barrow and Bliss doing her best to stabilize the front. Zara stopped us near the front entrance, where the scent of honeysuckle filled the air and mixed with a more chemical smell from one of the rooms we never, ever saw open. Like the tattoo room, Lorraine's room, and Avery's former playroom, the walls were opaque and solid, with a punch pad beside an honest-to-God door. We weren't supposed to be here.
And I'd still never seen Des put in his main door code. "Do you think if I asked for this one, he'd give it to me?"
"For the honeysuckle?"
"No, because we all avoid this part. And I wouldn't be seen as much."
"Ask him. Worst he can do at that point is say no."
"If I asked you right now to kill me, would you?"
I studied the empty glass case, because I didn't want to see if she was serious or not. Zara could be cruel, mocking the other girls until they cried, but she didn't have much of a sense of humor. "I guess I'm not that good a friend," I said finally. Bliss said nothing.
"Do you think it hurts?"
"He says it doesn't."
"And you believe him?"
"No," I sighed, leaning against the doorway into the plant life. "I don't think he knows one way or the other. I think he wants to believe there's no pain."
"What do you think she'll be like?"
"Who?"
"The next butterfly."
She craned her head back to stare at me, her brown eyes fever bright.
"He hasn't gone hunting in a long time. Not since Teresa. He's been so happy with Desmond here that he hasn't even looked for anyone else."
"He might not go look." She snorted. "He didn't always, though. Sometimes a girl died and he didn't go hunting. Not until someone else died. Sometimes he brought back one girl. Occasionally he brought back two, though he hadn't done that during my time here." Trying to understand why that man did anything the way he did was a worthless endeavor. We were still standing there when Lorraine came out of her room to start dinner. She seemed startled at first, one hand flying to the dark chestnut hair, somewhat faded and heavily streaked with silver, that she still wore long and up, as the gardener preferred. Even though he never looked at her, never commented on it, she still wore it that way. She glanced at the bandaged Zara, at how pale she was except for two bright blotches of red on her cheeks, then at the empty case. Zara's eyes narrowed.
"Wishing you were in there, Lorraine."
"I don't have to put up with you," the woman retorted.
"I know how you can be."
Suspicion warred with hope in fading blue eyes.
"You do?"
"Yeah. Magically become 30 years younger. I'm sure he'd love to kill and display you then."
Lorraine sniffed and stalked past us, slapping Zara's ankle on the way. The movement jarred the broken, infected hip, and she bit back a scream. Bliss's eyes followed the cook nurse.
"I'll send Danelle to help you back."
"Why, where are you?" I took a second look at her expression. "Right. Never mind. Danelle." The gasping Zara and I watched her jog away.
"What do you suppose she's doing?"
she asked after a minute.
"I'm not asking, and I don't want to know in advance," I said fervently. "Depending on what it is, I may not want to know after the fact, either."
A few minutes later, not just Danelle, but a very confused Marenka walked down the hall to join us.
"Should I ask what Bliss is doing?"
"No," we answered together.
"So I shouldn't ask why she borrowed my scissors?" murmured Marenka,
a hand to her throat where a ribbon usually held her tiny pair of embroidery scissors.
"Right."
Danelle thought about that, accepted it, and lightly touched the edge of the wheelbarrow. "Into the garden, or back to your room?"
"Room,"
groaned Zara.
"I think I get to take another painkiller."
Between us, Danelle, Marenka, and I got her settled back into bed with a glass of water and a happy pill. Then Bliss walked in, hands held behind her back, and an eminently satisfied look on her face.
"Oh God, I didn't want to know."
"I have a present for you, Zara,"
she announced cheerfully.
"Avery's head on a platter?"
"Close."
She tossed something onto the coverlet. Zara lifted it up to stare at it, then burst out laughing. It dangled from her hand, the ends slowly releasing from their pattern.
"Lorraine's braid?
Enjoy!"
"Think I could take it with me?"
Danelle rubbed the ends of the hair between her fingers.
"We could probably rebraid part of it into a garter for you."
"Or braid it into your hair like extensions."
"A crown, definitely."
Everyone who came in through the afternoon and evening had another suggestion to make, and it was an indication of our universal contempt for Lorraine that no one expressed any sorrow or sympathy for our cook nurse. When it was time for dinner, we all took our trays and crowded into Zara's room, all 20-odd of us, knee to knee on the floor and even in the shower. Adara lifted a glass of apple juice.
"To Zara, who can spit seeds farther than anyone else!"
We all laughed, even Zara, who raised her glass of water to return the toast. Nazira stood next, and I think we were all a little apprehensive about that one. Nazira and Zara got along about as well as Avery and Desmond.
"To Zara, who may be a right bitch, but she's our bitch."
Zara blew her a kiss. It was sick. I don't think there's a person there who doubted that. It was sick and wrong and profoundly twisted, and yet somehow it made us feel a lot better. One by one, we all stood and made a toast to Zara, some mocking, some serious. And sure, there were plenty of tears to be had, even if not by me. But maybe the gardener was right. Maybe this did help. When it was my turn, I stood and lifted my glass of water.
"To Zara, who's leaving us too soon, but who we will remember in a non-creepy fashion for the rest of our lives, however short they may be,"
added Bliss. How fucked up were we that we laughed? When everyone had taken their turn, Zara raised her glass once more.
"To Zara," she said quietly. "Because when she dies, Felicity Farrington will finally rest in peace."
"To Zara," we all murmured together, and drained our glasses. When the gardener came, it was without a dress but with Desmond, and he smiled to see all of us together.
"It's time, ladies."
Slowly, everyone kissed Zara, gathered their trays, and filed out of the room with the gardener kissing each and every one of them on the cheek. I waited until the end, perching on the side of the bed so I could take her clammy hand. Lorraine's silver-streaked braid was pinned like a coronet around her double twist. "Anything I can do?" I whispered. She dug under her pillow and gave me a battered, dog-eared, highlighted, and notated half-to-death copy of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
"I was really into theater in school," she said softly. "When I was taken from the park, I was supposed to be meeting my friends for a rehearsal. I've spent 3 years writing notes for a production I'll never do. Do you think you and Bliss could put together a reading for everyone? Just something to remember me by?"
I took the book and held it against my heart. "I promise."
"Take care of the next girl and try not to visit me too much, okay?"
"Okay." She pulled me into a tight hug, her fingers digging into my shoulders. Despite how calm she seemed, I could see her shaking. I let her hold on as long as she wanted, and when she finally took a deep breath and pulled away, I kissed her cheek. "I only just met you, Felicity Farrington, but I love you, and I will remember you."
"I guess that's as much as I can ask," she half-laughed. "Thank you, really and truly, for everything. You've made it all easier than it could have been."
"I wish I could have done more."
"You do what's yours to do. The rest belongs to them."
She jerked her head at the men in the doorway.
"I guess you'll see me in a couple of days."
"By the honeysuckle, so we'll almost never see you at all," I agreed, almost inaudibly. I kissed her again and walked out of the room, holding the book so tightly my knuckles popped. The gardener glanced at the braid that very obviously wasn't Zara's, then back at me.
"Lorraine's been crying," he murmured. "She says Bliss attacked her."
"It's just hair." I looked him square in the eyes. "She isn't you or your sons. We don't have to tolerate her hurting us."
"I'll speak with her."
He kissed my cheek and went to Zara, but Desmond held back with a puzzled, slightly worried frown.
"Is there something I'm missing?"
he asked me quietly. "Too much."
"I know you'll miss her, but we'll get her taken care of. She'll be fine."
"Don't."
"Maya, no.
You don't know. You should. You've seen enough." "Well, I do know. You don't get to tell me she'll be fine. Right now, you don't get to tell me anything."
Avery was the gardener's firstborn, but in the ways that mattered, Desmond was his heir. And before long, we'd find out just how much his father's son he was. I looked back at Zara, but the gardener was in the way. Ignoring Desmond's hurt gaze, I walked away.
Returning my tray to the kitchen, and taking a spiteful glee in Lorraine's sniffles and her mere inch and a half of ragged hair, I declined an offer from several of the girls to join them and went back to my room alone. After maybe half an hour, the walls came down. Zara was too injured for a final tryst after all, and Desmond was there with them. I curled up on my bed with the play, read all the notes in the margins, and got to know Felicity Farrington a little. Around 3 in the morning, the wall that blocked me from the hallway lifted. Only that wall. The ones to either side that looked through display cases, and, if you squinted, into Marenka's and Isra's rooms, stayed in place. They'd been there for weeks, and it was a strange breed of lovely to not see dead bodies every time I opened my eyes. I closed the book on my finger, steeling myself to see the gardener in the doorway, one hand at his belt and his eyes full of excitement. But it was Desmond, his pale green eyes haunted and bruised in a way I hadn't seen in months. He clutched the glass wall to keep himself standing, his knees buckling and swaying with every attempt to support his weight. I closed the book properly, slid it onto the shelf, and sat up on the bed. He took a few wobbly steps into the room and fell hard to his knees. He buried his face in his hands, then flinched violently, staring at his hands like they'd somehow become separate from the rest of him. A sickly, sour, chemical smell wafted around him, the same scent I noticed any time I went near the honeysuckles at the front door. His entire body shook as he doubled over, pressing his forehead against the cool metal floor. Almost 10 minutes passed before he said a word, and even then his voice was hoarse and broken.
"He promised we would take care of her."
"He did,"
He
put her out of pain and prevented her from decay, I said neutrally.
Murdered her.
Not entirely his father's son, then. I pulled off my clothing and knelt down in front of him, unbuttoning his shirt. He gave me a sick look and batted my hands away. I'm putting you in the shower, you reek.
Formaldehyde, he muttered.
This time he let me undress him, and stumbled along behind me as I pulled him across the room to sit in the shower. A twist of my wrist sent warm water pouring over him. There was nothing sexual about what happened next. It was like bathing Sophia's girls when they were half asleep. When I told him to lean forward or lift his arm or close his eyes, he obeyed. But numbly, like it didn't entirely make sense. My shampoo and body wash were both fruity as hell, but I washed him head to toe until the only remaining chemical smell was his clothing. I draped him in towels and used one of his shoes to push the clothing out into the hallway, then returned to dry both of us off. I had to keep wiping his face. Unseen in the shower, a constant stream of tears ran down his cheeks.
"He injected something to make her sleep," he whispered. "I thought we were going to carry her out to the car, but he opened a room I'd never seen before."
A shudder racked his body.
"Once she fell asleep, he put her in this orange and yellow dress and laid her out on an embalming table, and then he hooked up."
"Please don't tell me," I said quietly.
"No, I have to, because he's going to do that to you someday, isn't he? That's how he keeps you, by embalming you while you're still alive."
Another shudder, a sob that fractured his voice, but he continued.
"He stood there explaining all the steps to me, so I could do it on my own someday," he said. "Love was more than just the pleasure," he said. "We had to be willing to do the hard things, too," he said. He said...
"Come on, you're still shivering." He let me lead him to the bed and pull the covers up over him, and I sat beside him, atop the blanket, hands in my lap.
"He said if I really loved you, I wouldn't let any hand other than my own take care of you."
"Des?"
"He showed me some of the others. I thought he just left them back on the streets. I didn't realize..."
He broke down completely, weeping with an intensity that damn near shook the bed. I rubbed circles on his back as he choked on the sobs, unable to give him more comfort than that because he still didn't know the full truth. Zara had the bone infection. And he thought all broken people killed themselves or let themselves go so completely that they died. He didn't know about attitudes and ages. And at that moment, when he was so close to broken himself, I couldn't bring myself to tell him. I couldn't use him broken. I needed him brave. I didn't think he ever would be.
"She picked out her case," he managed a few minutes later. "He made me carry her there, showed me how to pose her, how to close the glass completely to pour the resin in. Before he closed the glass, he...
kissed her goodbye. He gave a jerky nod, hiccuping with the force of his sobs.
"He told her he loved her."
"As he understands it, he does."
"How can you even stand to be around me?"
"Sometimes I can't," I admitted. "I keep telling myself that you don't know the whole of it, that you're still ignorant of so much of what your father and brother do, and some days that's the only way I can even look at you. But you..."
"Please tell me."
"But you're a coward," I sighed. "You know that keeping us here is wrong. You know it's against the law. You know he rapes us, and now you know he kills us. Some of these girls might even have families looking for them. You know this is wrong, but you don't report it. You said you were going to learn how to be braver for me, but you haven't. And I honestly don't know if you can."
"Finding out about this? Having it all come out, it would kill my mother."
I shrugged. "Give it enough time and it'll kill me too. Cowardice may be our natural state, but it's still a choice. Every day you know about the garden and don't call the police or let us go, you're making that same choice again and again. It is what it is, Desmond.
You just don't get to pretend anymore. He started weeping again. Or maybe it was weeping still. All one massive shock that just kept compounding past his ability to bear it. He spent the rest of that dark morning lying silently on my bed. And when sunlight came to the garden, he gathered up his formaldehyde-scented clothing and walked away. He didn't talk to me for weeks, and only came into the garden once, to see Zara after the resin solidified and the wall came away from her case. All the walls lifted then, and the reality that had blurred over the summer crashed back down with resounding force. We were butterflies, and our short lives would end in glass.
"Wait, I thought you said things changed with Keeley," Edison says.
"I did, yes. I'm getting there."
"Oh." She rubs her thumbs against the blue dragon's neck and takes a deep breath. "Keeley arrived 4 days ago."
It took time to keep my promise to Zara. The gardener readily agreed to get us a full set of A Midsummer Night's Dream when I told him what it was for, but he wanted the affair done right. He ordered up all sorts of costumes and gave Bliss a box of clays that weighed as much as she did to make us flower crowns. We assigned parts and coached girls through the language. Some of them had read a play or two in English, but most didn't have much in the way of real exposure.
I'd lived for almost 2 years with Noemi, who walked around the apartment in her underwear reading aloud soliloquies as she brushed her teeth. Yes, brushed her teeth, which for that very reason took for fucking ever.
When the evening arrived, the gardener had Lorraine arrange a feast in the garden itself, spread on both sides of the little stream. We had these strange chairs somewhere between an ottoman and a beanbag, all in bright colors, and each of us had semi-sheer silk gowns in beautiful colors that for once had nothing to do with the wings inked on our backs. I was reading for Helena, and the gardener had given me a gown of forest and moss greens, with a single layer of deep rose. That was the color Bliss matched for my crown of clay roses. Most of us wore our hair down under the crowns, simply because for that one night we could. There was a sharp edge to the laughter as we all prepared. We were doing this for Zara, but the gardener had made it into a fancy. Even knowing our reason for it, I'm sure he was convinced that it was a measure of how happy we were under his loving care that we wanted to put on an entertainment for him. That man had an astonishing talent for seeing what he wanted to see. He hadn't even noticed that Lorraine had bought a wig so she could still seem to have long, well-maintained hair for him to want to play with. A sick bitch. And he persuaded Desmond to attend. He was thrown, I think, by his son's reaction to Zara's death. Des was his father's son, but he didn't have his perspective. Desmond couldn't see it as anything but murder, yet it didn't push him into action. At the end of the first week of silence and absence from his son, the gardener came to my room before breakfast.
"Desmond seems very out of sorts," he announced as soon as I was marginally awake. "Did you two argue?"
I yawned.
"He's having trouble processing what happened to Zara."
"But Zara's fine. She's out of pain."
He honestly seemed confused. "When you said you were going to take care of her, he thought you meant take her to a hospital."
"That would have been foolish. There would have been questions asked."
"All I'm doing is translating."
"Yes, of course. Thank you, Maya."
I'm sure there were a number of father-son conversations in the intervening weeks to which I wasn't privy, but Desmond showed up for the reading looking like he hadn't slept for shit. He must have had a presentation in class that day, because he was wearing a dress shirt and tie with his khakis. Granted, the shirt was open at the collar, the tie loose, and the sleeves rolled back, but it was still dressier than usual. And I was somewhat disgusted with myself for the fleeting thought that the seafoam green shirt looked very good with his eyes. He had a hard time looking directly at any of us, especially me. I'd told Bliss the gist of our last discussion over a night of making fake chocolate chip cookies with which to trick Lorraine. She'd shrugged and said I was kinder than she would have been. Seeing as the clay cookies were her idea, I didn't argue. The reading started really well. Until Zara's notes, I'd never paid much attention to the words. Once you hear to be or not to be mangled by toothpaste, it gets a little hard to care. But this was a really funny play, and we amped it up wherever we could. Bliss played Hermia, and during one of the scenes where we argued, she actually pounced on me from across the stream, startling a belly laugh from the gardener. In the middle of one of Marenka's speeches as Puck, the front door slammed open to frame Avery, a tiny bundle over one shoulder. Marenka stopped and looked to me, her eyes wide within her mask of a white peacock. I stood and went to her side, watching Avery jog into the garden. After a moment, the gardener and Desmond stood beside us.
"I brought us a new one,"
Avery announced, his face wreathed in smiles. He shrugged off his burden, letting it drop to the sand.
"I found her. I got her. Look, Father, see what I found for us?"
The gardener was too busy staring at his older son, so I knelt down and twitched aside the wrapped blanket with shaking hands. A few of the girls screamed. Oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fucking shit. The girl inside hadn't even hit puberty yet. Blood crusted on one side of her face in streaks from her temple, the fair skin there already starting to bruise, and other bruises, scratches, and impressions could be seen through tears in her clothing as I pulled away the rest of the blanket. More blood soaked her thighs and the fabric around it. Shit, her underwear was covered with pink and purple cursive Saturdays, the kind of thing you just know they don't make in big girl sizes. A really inappropriate part of my brain noted that it was only Thursday. She was small, with gangly limbs and the impression of growth, like suddenly she'd shoot up. Pretty, in a preteen kind of way, with a ruined ponytail of almost copper hair, but very, very young. I wrapped the blanket back around her to hide the blood and held her close, utterly speechless.
"Avery,"
whispered the shocked gardener.
"What the hell have you done?"
I absolutely did not want to be a part of that conversation. Danelle helped me stand with the girl in my arms, supporting her head.
"Bliss, your dress with the back, can we have that?"
She nodded and raced away to her room. Danelle and I walked quickly to my room, where we stripped the girl, threw her ruined clothing in a laundry chute, and washed her. I had to wash the blood from her thighs and gently squirt more water into her to flush the fluids and bits of torn tissue. Danelle was busy retching into the toilet. She came back, wiping a shaky hand across her mouth.
"She doesn't even have any hair down there yet," she whispered.
No hair on her crotch or underarms, no breasts, no hips. This was definitely still a child. Danelle held her up so I could wash her hair. By then, Bliss was there with her dress, the only thing that was likely to fit her and keep her fully covered, even if it was a bit loose. So we got her dried off, clothed, and tucked into my bed. "Now that she's here, do you think..." Not even Bliss could finish that thought. I shook my head, inspecting the girl's hand where several nails had torn short. She must have fought. "They're not touching her. Maya, they're not touching her!" A pained bellow ripped through the garden, and we flinched. But it wasn't from a female, so we didn't move. Other girls fled from the sound, crowding into my room, until I finally had to tell most of them to leave. We had no idea when this child was going to wake up, and she was going to be terrified and in pain, and really didn't need 20-something people staring at her. Only Danelle and Bliss stayed, Danelle keeping herself behind the girl so her face wouldn't be seen right away. Except the bookshelf on my right wall didn't entirely hide Lionette. Bliss tugged the curtain from my toilet as far as it could go, lifting the bottom and tucking it between several of the books to anchor it. If you knew something was there, you could still see her hair, the curve of her spine, but not at a casual glance. And we waited. Bliss made a quick errand to fetch bottles of water, as well as bullying a few aspirin out of the cowed Lorraine. Aspirin wasn't going to do much in the long run. It was great against headaches from the drugs, but that wasn't what she had. But it was something anyway. Then the gardener appeared in my doorway. He glanced at the wall and the arrangement of the curtain, then to the girl on the bed, and nodded, reaching into his pocket. He pulled out a small control, and after a minute or so of fiddling with it, the walls came down on either side,
leaving the front open.
How is she?
Unconscious, I said shortly. She's been raped, she's been hit very hard in the head, and she'll have a world of other hurts.
Was there anything to show her name or where she came from?
No. I gave her hand to Bliss so I could walk across the room, standing right next to the pale, suddenly worn-looking man. No one touches her.
Maya.
No, no one touches her. No wings, no sex, nothing. She is a child. To my shock, he actually nodded.
I'm giving her to your care.
Danelle cleared her throat. Sir, she hasn't actually woken up yet. Couldn't she be taken somewhere, left at a hospital or something? She wouldn't know anything.
I can't trust that she didn't see Avery,
he said heavily.
She has to stay.
Danelle bit her lip and looked away, her hands stroking the girl's hair. I think it best if you leave, I told him evenly. We don't know when she's going to wake up. It would be best not to have any males present.
Of course, yes. You'll tell me if she needs anything.
She needs her mother and her virginity, snapped Bliss. She needs to be safely at home!
Bliss.
She snorted, but fell silent at his warning tone.
You'll tell me,
he said again, and I nodded. I didn't bother to watch him leave. He wasn't gone long before Desmond came, that bruised look even stronger in his eyes.
Will she be all right?
No, I said stiffly. But I think she'll live.
That yell? Father caned Avery.
Yes, because that will make her feel so much better, Bliss snarled. Go fuck yourself.
What did he do to her?
What do you think he did to her? Shook her hand? Desmond? I didn't continue until he was finally looking at me, meeting my eye. This is what your brother is, but it's what all three of you do, so right now you need to not be here. I know you're all full of self-pity and loathing right now, but I will not have any males around this child. You need to go.
I'm not the one who hurt her.
Yes, you are, I snapped. You could have prevented this. If you had just gone to the police or let one of us go so we could go to the police, Avery wouldn't have been free to kidnap her, to savage her, to rape her, to bring her here where it will happen to her again and again and again until she's dead too young. You allowed this to happen, Desmond, actively allowed it. So yes, you are the one who hurt her. If you're not going to do anything to help her, you need to get the hell away from her. He stared at me, his face pale and shocked. Then he turned and walked away. How could a child be worth less than a name? How could all our lives be worth less than a reputation? Bliss looked after him, then reached out to touch my hand. Do you think he'll come back? I don't care. It was even mostly true. I was tired in a way that went deeper than my bones. I simply did not have the energy to think about Desmond's continued uselessness. The girl finally regained consciousness around 2 a.m, groaning as she started to feel all the various aches and pains. I sat on the bed and gave her hand a gentle squeeze. Keep your eyes closed, I said softly, pitching my voice low and comforting as Lionette had taught me. I'd pretty much never done it before, but this girl needed me to be softer to her, fiercer for her. Sophia, I thought, would have recognized that distinction. I'm going to put a damp cloth over your face to help take away some of that pain. Danelle wrung out the washcloth and handed it to me.
Where? What?
We'll get to that in a bit, I promise. Can you swallow pills? She started crying.
Please don't drug me. I'll be good. I promise I won't fight anymore.
It's aspirin, nothing more. I promise you that. It's only to help the pain a little. She let me sit her up enough to put the pills on her tongue and drink some water.
Who are you?
My name is Maya. I was taken by the same people who took you, but I'm not going to let them hurt you anymore. They won't be able to touch you.
I want to go home.
I know, I whispered, adjusting the cloth over her eyes.
I know you do. I'm so sorry.
I don't want to be blind anymore. Please let me see.
I shielded her eyes and slid away the cloth, watching her blink even against that much light. Her eyes were different colors, one blue and one gray, and the blue one had two freckles in the iris. I angled my hand so she could see my face without staring directly into the overhead light. Better?
I hurt,
she whimpered. Tears spilled from the corner of her eyes into her hair.
I know you do, sweetheart, I know.
She rolled over and pressed her face into my lap, her skinny arms wrapping around my hips.
I want my mom.
I know, sweetheart. I curled over her, my hair spilling around her like that was any kind of shield, and held her as tightly as I could without causing pain.
I'm sorry.
Sophia's Jilly would be 11 by now. This girl seemed around the same age, maybe a year older. But thinking of Jilly hurt just then. This child just looked so young and fragile, so broken. I didn't want to think of bold little Jilly like that. She cried herself back to sleep, and when she woke again a few hours later, Bliss brought us all fruit.
Lorraine didn't make breakfast, she whispered to me and Danelle. She's been sitting in the kitchen staring at the wall all night, according to Zulema and Willa.
I nodded and took one of the bananas, taking my seat next to the child.
Here, you must be hungry.
Not really, she said miserably.
Part of that is shock, but try to eat anyway. The potassium will help your muscles, help them not be so tight and painful.
She gave a quivering sigh, but took the banana and bit into it.
This is Bliss, I said, pointing to my tiny friend. And this is Danelle. Can you tell us your name?
Healy Rudolph, she answered. I live in Sharpsburg, Maryland.
Forever and a half ago, Julian had said something about Maryland.
Healy, do you think you can be brave for me?
Tears welled up in her eyes again, but God love her, she nodded.
Healy, this place is called the Garden. There's a man and his two sons who take us and keep us here. They make sure we have food and clothing, that we have what we need, but they don't let us go.
I am so sorry that you were kidnapped and brought here, but I can't change that. I can't promise that you'll ever see your home or family again.
She sniffled, and I slid my arm around her shoulders, hugging her against my side.
I know it's hard. I'm not just saying that, I really do know. But I promise you that I will take care of you. I won't let them hurt you. Those of us who are kept here form a kind of family. We argue sometimes and we don't always like each other, but we're a family, and family looks out for each other.
Bliss gave me a crooked smile. Even though she didn't know much, she knew that wasn't how I'd been raised. But I'd gotten a taste of that in the apartment, and I'd learned the rest of it here. We were a fucked-up family, but a family nonetheless. Healy looked at Danelle and shrank against me.
Why does she have a tattoo on her face? She whispered.
Danelle knelt down in front of the bed, taking both of Keely's hands in hers.
This is another thing you have to be brave for, she said gently. Do you want to hear it now, or do you want to wait for a little bit?
Biting her lip, the child gave me an uncertain look.
It's your choice, I told her. Now or later, you can choose. If it makes it easier, I promise that it's not going to happen to you.
With a deep, shaky breath, she nodded.
Now then.
The man who keeps us? We call him the gardener, Danelle said simply. He likes to think of us as butterflies in his garden, and he tattoos wings on our backs because it helps him pretend. When I was first brought here, I thought that if I made him like me more than anyone else, he'd let me go and I could go home. I was wrong, but I didn't learn that quickly enough, and he did the wings on my face to show others that he thought I was happy with what he did.
Healy looked up at me again. You have wings, too?
On my back, yes.
Her eyes flicked over to Bliss, who nodded.
But you won't let him do that to me.
I won't let him touch you at all.
We took her out into the garden in the early afternoon, Bliss going ahead of us to warn the other girls.
Normally, most of the others stayed away from the new girl until she was settled. Keely was different. Singly or in pairs, as non-threateningly as possible, every girl but Sirvat came to say hello, to introduce herself, and maybe, most importantly, to promise that they'd help protect her. I was okay with Sirvat absenting herself from that. Marenka knelt down and let Keely trace the white, browns, and black of the wings on her face, so she wouldn't be scared anymore.
"I'm going to move my things so you'll be right next to Maya," she told her. "That way, if you get scared or don't want to be alone, you won't have to worry about getting lost. You'll be right next to her."
"Thank you," she managed.
Lorraine roused herself enough to put together a cold lunch for us, though she was crying the entire time. I wanted to believe that maybe she'd finally realized just what the gardener was, that she was horrified that a child so young had been taken, that she was mortified over how she'd been mooning and jealous of dead girls. I really wanted to believe that little bit of good of her. I didn't, though. I didn't know why she was so shocked and upset, but I didn't think it was for anyone's situation but hers. Maybe buying the wig, or, more likely, Bliss not getting in trouble for the attack, finally made her realize that the gardener was never going to love her again. We took our lunches up on the cliff, where the sun was warm and the space around us open. Keely still didn't have much of an appetite, but she ate to humor us. Then she saw Desmond walking up the path, and she buried herself against me. Bliss and Danelle moved in close as well, protecting her from all sides. Desmond wasn't the threat, but he was a male. I understood the impulse. He stopped a safe distance away, kneeling down on the rock and spreading his arms wide.
"I'm not going to hurt you," he said quietly. "I'm not going to touch you or even come any closer than this."
I shook my head. "Why are you here?"
"To ask her name and where she came from, so I can do what's right."
I started to scoot off the rock, but Keely's arms tightened around my waist. "It's okay," I whispered, hugging her close. "I'm just going to go talk to him. You can stay right here with Bliss and Danelle."
"What if he hurts you?" she whimpered.
"He won't. This one doesn't. I'll be right back. You'll see me the whole time." She slowly released me to transfer her grip to Danelle. Bliss was soft and curvy, but she was not cuddly. I walked past Desmond to the very edge of the cliff, and, after a moment, he followed me. He stood a foot or so away, shoving his hands deep in his pockets. "What are you doing?"
"What's right?" he answered. "I'm calling the police, but I need to know her name. There's got to be an Amber Alert out for her."
"Why now? You've known about the garden for 6 months now."
"How old is she?"
I glanced back at her over my shoulder. She and her friends were hanging out at the mall to celebrate her 12th birthday. He swore and steadied his feet, the toes of his shoes a little over the edge of the rock.
"I've been trying so hard to convince myself that my father is telling the truth, that even if you're not here by choice, you at least came from something he could rescue you from."
And still, in the face of this 12-year-old girl, he was deluding himself.
"The streets, maybe, or bad families," he continued. "Something that made this just a little bit better, but I can't. I know it was Avery who took her, not Father, but this has to stop. You're right, I am a coward, and I am selfish because I don't want to hurt my family, and I don't want to go to jail, but that girl is..."
He stopped, panting with the force of his words and the tangle of emotion behind them.
"I kept telling myself that I needed to learn to be braver, and Jesus, what a stupid thing to think. You don't learn to be brave, you just have to do what's right, even if it scares you. So I'm calling the police with as many names as I know and telling them about the garden."
"You're really calling?" I asked. He flashed me an angry look. "Yes, I'm asking, because I can't go tell that girl that help is on the way if you're going to back out or bury your head back in the sand. Are you really doing this?" He took a deep breath.
"Yes. I'm really doing this."
I reached out and lightly touched his cheek to bring his eyes to mine.
Her name is Keely Rudolph, and she lives in Sharpsburg.
Thank you.
He turned to walk away, then stopped, walked back, and pulled me into a searing kiss, and then walked away without another word. I returned to the Rock.
We need to stay in my room for the rest of today, I told the girls. Go ahead without me, I'm just going to tell everyone else.
Do you really think he's gonna do it? Liz asked.
I think he's finally going to try, and God help him if it doesn't work.
Go, quickly.
It was like the ultimate game of hide-and-seek, tracking down each girl and telling her to stay in her room.
I didn't care if they were in their own rooms, just that they were out of the garden proper. Because as soon as the gardener learned about that call, the walls were coming down, and I didn't even want to think about what would happen to any girl he found outside of them. Every word was whispered, because I didn't know how strong the mics were, and didn't know if the gardener had already heard what his son intended.
I found Eleni and Isra in the cave, Teresa in the music room, Marenka in the room that would no longer be hers, with Ravenna and Nazira helping her pack all of her embroidery stuff.
Willa and Zulema were in the kitchen, watching Lorraine cry hard enough to set her wig askew. Pia was at the pond, studying the sensors for the water level. One by one, I found them, and passed the news along, and they walked quickly away. Sirva was the last one I found, her entire front pressed against the glass of Zara's display case. The intricate black, white, and orange-yellow wings of a pearl crescent filled her back, and her eyes were closed as she stood, motionless.
Sirvat, what the fuck are you doing?
She opened one eye to look at me.
Trying to imagine what it's like in there?
Seeing as she's dead, I don't think she can help you with that. She doesn't know either.
Can you smell it?
The honeysuckle? She shook her head and backed away from the glass.
The formaldehyde. My biology teacher used it to preserve specimens for dissection. They must have a ton of it in that room, because the smell is so strong here.
It's where he prepares us for the cases, I sighed. Sirvat, we need to stay in the rooms. The shit's hitting the fan.
Because of Keely?
And Desmond. She touched the locked door, protected by its lock code.
We always had to be really careful with the formaldehyde. Even diluted in alcohol, it's not always stable.
I never felt bad for not being closer to Sirvat. She was a strange duck. But she let me pull her away and toss her into her room.
I ran back up onto the cliff and up one of the trees to try and see if anything was going on, but I couldn't even see the house, much less the front of the property.
The gardener had plenty of money and plenty of space, a bad combination when it comes to psychopathic tendencies. The lights flickered violently, and I hurled myself over the edge of the cliff, scraping and banging as I clambered down the rough holds and through the waterfall to get to my room before the walls came down. Bliss handed me a towel.
It occurs to me, half an hour too late, that we might have been better off all getting together in one place in the garden. If Desmond tells the cops that we're in the inner greenhouse, they'd insist on checking it out, right? If we were out there, they'd see us.
Believe it or not, I thought of that. I stripped off my soaked dress and pulled on the dress I'd been given at Desmond's arrival, the one with the back. It wasn't one of the gardener's favorites because it obscured the wings, but at the moment I didn't care. I wanted to be running, to be fighting, to be doing almost anything but sit in that tiny room and wait. If he's able to talk the police out of investigating, or if he was able to convince Desmond not to make the call, what do you suppose he'll do to anyone who disobeyed the room call?
Damn it.
Liz, I'm scared, I whispered. I sank down onto the bed and reached for Keely's hand. She took it and curled into me, seeking comfort. I hate not being able to hear anything. Marenka and I had once experimented with shrieking at the top of our lungs during a maintenance session. Our rooms were right next to each other's, and we couldn't hear a thing. Even the vents closed when the walls came down. Hours passed before the walls went up. We stayed in the rooms at first, too scared to move, for all we'd hated sitting still. Then we couldn't stand it anymore and walked out into the garden to see how our world had changed. Maybe, finally, it was for the better.
Was it? Edison asks when it's clear she's not going to continue.
No.
Part 3.
Inara rubs her thumbs against the sad little dragon.